Well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Thank you for joining us. Henrik here with Red Ice TV. It's great to have you back with us again. If you're joining us for the first time, make sure you check out and subscribe to our YouTube channel, of course. But you can always find our stuff at redice.tv and our full programming at redicemembers.com as well. This is where we host all of our own materials. So that's really our own platform. So definitely make sure that you check out redicemembers.com for all the material. So today for our featured interview, we have a really interesting show. I think you're going to like this one. We have Phil Simpson with us on the line, and he's more well known as, let me go over to this page here so you can see, Mimir's Brunner. Is kind of the old Norse way of saying it, really. This is Mimir's well of knowledge, the wisdom well, really, in old Norse mythology. And he's done fantastic work on the Kimbri, on a lot of other Norse mythology and stuff like that. So I just discovered his work probably like a week ago. And I was looking at one of his videos on the consequences of cowardice, which was just wonderful, beautiful video, very inspiring. And so I wanted to get Phil on to talk with him about his work and kind of dive deeper into the Kimbri as well. So thank you for coming on, Phil. It's great to have you here.
It's good to be here, Henrik. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Thank you. Awesome. Looking forward to this and definitely want to talk more about, you know, the Kimbri in specifics specifically. That's what you've focused on, at least at this stage. Tell us first a little bit if there's anything people should know about the name Mimir's Brunner. We had a school in the town that I grew up that is named Mimir's Brunner. I don't know how much wisdom you can go and get there, but nonetheless, it's actually a name that's was used in my very own vicinity at the time. But it's like a wellspring of wisdom, correct?
Yes, yeah. I mean, it's one of the three main wells in Norse mythology, but. For me, I've had an affinity with water, especially I think it's one of the lesser known mystical elements of our past. We talk about the gods, goddesses, and it's all talked about. But I mean, the water worship has gone on for, well, at least the Neolithic, but probably the Mesolithic too. And it's followed straight through. I mean, even today, we have wishing wells, right, where we throw our coin in, a votive offering, and make a wish to the gods and goddesses.
That's which is, right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So there's a lot of correlation, I guess, or a way of looking at things which has kind of been passed down to us even to this day. It's not something that's gone away, right?
Yeah, I believe that wells and sacred waterways were a way of communicating with the gods and goddesses and the ancestors through votive offerings, like I say, that go back to the Mesolithic. Well, more so the Neolithic, but certainly probably even the Mesolithic, where we would put votive offering, for anybody who doesn't know, we threw things in that were worth a terrible amount of money. Some of those swords that are thrown in Norse times into waterways, etc., are probably the equivalent of, a couple of Rolls Royces in value, you know? Yeah. And they were throwing them into the ancestors and the gods of the land and the goddesses, specifically with waterways. So, yeah, it came really from that and just... Obviously, Mimir's well, it's known for giving Woden wisdom, so I'm trying to partake my wisdom, which is not necessarily the whole truth, but my take on our ancestral origin.
Well, it's a fascinating work that you're involved in, and I remember the first time I heard about the Kimbri, mm-hmm. how, I don't know what it was, if it was just something that immediately just caught my imagination, my... sense of awe and my sense of veneration, or I can't put the words on it. It was a number of feelings I had the first time I looked at that famous map, really, right, of the battles, yeah. of their emigration path from basically the south of Denmark, north of Germany, depending on where you draw the line. Jutland, it was called then, which people believe goes back to the name Jut, is an old word for giant. And so it was the land of the giants, potentially one of the etymological words of that. But supposedly these Kimbri, which was, we don't know how far back they were occupying this particular area of Denmark, but around, what is it, around the year zero, really, or a little bit before that, something happened.
113 BC, yeah.
There you go.
Well, 150, we're not sure, but the battle started about 113 BC, so it was a bit before that, but yeah. There was some kind of the ancient writers tell us an inundation of the sea or some kind of flood, or some actually say earthquakes, but we know some natural disaster caused them to move south on a very powerful journey. And I agree with you. When the first time I read about the Cimbri and started to learn about them, there is something that draws you to them. And on the way, I've learned many lessons through my just trying to understand their behavior, because some of it can seem very alien to us, and it doesn't quite go with logic sometimes what they do. But trying to understand that can actually teach you about yourself. And this goes for many of our ancestral stories, mythology, and what the Romans tell us, even if the Romans may sometimes embellish their side a little.
Well, that's what I was going to say, that we don't know. Maybe there are things coming to us from the written record which doesn't make sense because they just didn't record it right, or there's gaps in the story, or there's something, or again, there's just simply bias. I remember I've heard people, for example, they say, well, if you want to find out about the Celts, read what Julius Caesar wrote about them. And it's like, well, you're not going to kind of get the exact correct version of it, shall I say, right? So there is, just because it's a written word, it doesn't mean that it's the absolute truth. And we always have to keep that in mind, of course.
You have to take every bit of information that is given to you and study individually, really. That's how I go about it. I try to correlate the written word with the archaeological evidence, things. And remember, we are the blood of those people, or not necessarily the Cimbri, but of the same types of people that existed in the north. There has been no major invasions. Even the Roman Empire left very little genetic material up in the north, even Britain, where they conquered. We're pretty much the same types of people. I mean, the Cimbri have got a lot of interesting links to Britain, even. We have the River Humber, which literally would be the River Cumber, or Cimbri, and it means where rivers join together is the etymology of it. And we have Cumbria, Northumbria. These are all etymologically very similar to the Cimbri, so there could be some relationship there. And we know that they were related to the Belgae tribes just a little bit south, and we know the Belgae tribes were related to the Brits, etc. So it's kind of an interwoven, although we may not be the direct descendants of these people that migrated south, we are blood of their blood.
So yeah, all certainly.
They can teach us a lot about ourselves. And like I said, this is what Mimersbrunn is partly about, especially in the time when history is being, how should we put it? Our ancestors' names are being dragged through the mud, in all honesty.
Yeah.
In many ways. I mean, like we had with... in America recently, with the southern removal of memorials, etc. In England recently, I saw on the 11th of November, when we celebrate the heroes of World War II. Now, whatever you may think of that, but in the posters, there was like one white guy, and there was like all these other races that fought. But they're hiding our history from us. So that is one of the reasons that Mimersbrunn is there, and also to give her more of a opposition to the black pill. When you get involved in this, as you all know, Henrik, is as you go deeper, you can get overwhelmed with the power that we're up against. Much like our ancestors did with Rome, and the Cimbri are a good antidote to that, what appears to be unbeatable.
Yeah, it definitely is. If you can encapsulate the concept of a hero's journey into a people, that this would be it effectively, right? And here's that kind of that famous map. Like if you Google on Wikipedia and stuff, this is what you get, right? Their path. And and as you said, we don't really know why they left, but there's other similar emigrations that occurred in Scandinavia. One is the famous of the Vinlini, which left from Öland, which is the second largest island off of the east coast of Sweden, where supposedly they were basically so numerous that they were running out of space, effectively. There was,
They
drew lots, exactly. And like a third of the people was asked to leave, effectively, instead, and hunt for a new territory, new land, right? So they were very extremely successful to gain those kinds of numbers at that time. And of course, what's interesting is that as they moved further south, it was a disaster for many of the people that encountered them, because they were just so, they were overpowering, essentially, right?
They were irresistible, according to the Romans, and came on like fire. So, immigrations from the northwest to the east and the southeast specifically are very common. The Geats, as you all know, Henry.
Absolutely. Don't get me started on that. I'll take over the show and start talking about that in a step.
the Geats, the name, the etymology, probably comes from Tupor. And that etymology was speculated by Roman historians at the time that they poured out and were the origin of many nations. So that goes in with the later stories, actually, that they were doing this for a very long period of time, known to the Romans, that they would pour out from the north and invade. I mean, the Galati and the Gauls. I mean, there's this idea that the Gauls and Germanics and the Celts and the Germanics, sorry, and all this separation, but with the Cimbri, there's very little difference, even though they would be classed as a Germanic tribe, with the actual Gauls, and we're very related to them, especially the northern Gauls and the Celts.
Yeah, there's definitely overlap that, and you know, again, you know, looking at a map of a Roman map of how they mapped and stuff like that, and you realize so many of the names, like even the Suebi or even the Alemanni, right? That actually, many of those names are collection names, which meant us or all of us or we, the people, and you know, names like that, right? That but basically
Teutones.
Is that the same with Teutones?
Tribe. Yeah. Tribe. Oh, interesting. It means tribe.
Now, so is the Cimbri and the Teutones the same, by the way?
There's a lot of discussion there. Some people believe that they're just related to the they're just related somehow, so they may have had a similar origin, but have gone their disparate ways, but still remember that origin, obviously. And I think that's true of most of the North. Like I say, there's many, all of the recorded, I mean, although we get genetically, and a lot of people put these genetic tests out, that east to west migrations, all the historical record shows actually northwestern to southeastern migration, actually, like the Galati that occupied Turkey and fought the Greeks, that they were Gauls from the north somewhere.
And it was just, as you said, so many, as I started looking into that and the different names, the Heruli and Sionis, obviously the Teutons, the well, Anglo-Saxons is probably from one of those famous known of those that went to England later on. But, you know, the Rugi, there's these interesting connections between parts of Norway, which has the same name, supposedly named after the fact that they were farmers of rye, right? The rye or whatever. All these interesting kind of name connections, right? But you realize, as you said, that they were just, these northern tribes were just pouring out during different stages, you know, in European history, and they left their mark tremendously on the European continent as we see it today. In many cases, of course, we hear that they are, you know, they were uncivilized and they were barbarians and all this kind of stuff. But the fact is that even, I don't want to talk about Notre Dame Cathedral right now, but there was even people that talked about that, which was kind of interesting, that some of the architectural style, there's a reason why it's named Gothic architecture, right? Initially, that was meant to seen as a derogatory term, but the fact that the Goths also had a kind of a similar path, right, of leaving first Scandinavia, then down towards really what's today Poland, and then going down to obviously Italy and kind of further to the east of becoming the Visigoths, and then you have the Ostrogoths becoming, actually flip that, sorry, the Visigoths were over on the Spanish side later, but they had a similar kind of, they left a similar mark, and they also contributed immensely to those civilizations when they started rising up, and the achievements that we recognize for those people having today, right?
Yes, definitely. I mean, like I say, that even Rome itself was surrounded by Gaulish tribes. I mean, if we take the Cimbrian War for an example, one of their allies was the Ambrones, and they meet, and I forget their name now, but they meet a tribe when they get ambushed. The tribe that's fighting them actually starts shouting back the name Ambrones whilst banging on their shields, because they were of the same blood. But they migrated south at an earlier time and had become Roman by this point, or absorbed into Roman culture. So there's evidence that this northern tribe's coming down to fight a war with Rome, and it's meeting some of its own people, essentially.
I know, and that's what's so strange, right? Because there are these tales of the fact that many of them also continued, obviously, to have contact with the native lands which they left. And again, since I've been very interested with the Goths and you know, coming from that area of Sweden, which they are believed to originally have come from. There is so much gold that have been found in Götaland or that part of Sweden, which I'm kind of highlighting, I guess, or circling right now with the mouse pointer. But the fact that most of the gold that has been found was probably due to the fact that the Goths down at that time in Rome had done extortions and stuff like that on them, and basically said, "You pay us gold or we'll attack you." It was like a kind of a pre-Viking Danegeld type of thing almost, right? And much of that gold ended up back in the home in the motherland, I guess, in Sweden, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of evidence that when we were given gold for whatever reason by the Romans, that we've just melted it down. I mean, there's an interesting concept with the whole idea of gold and wealth. I mean, our ancestors took it with them. We didn't accumulate it or store it. We saw a man's worth as what he did in his lifetime. Before we got, we can talk about this a little bit later about real nobility. I mean, before we got the idea of hereditary rule, I think we had a more meritocracy type relationship there, where there were noble families, but each generation had to prove itself as being worthy of leadership of life, and that's kind of the story of the Cimbri. And it works in nature. I try to look at all things through nature's eye. And, you know, a lion may rule a pride all his life and have many sons, but out of those sons don't get given a pride because of their father's name. Their blood has to be proved in that time, in their time. And this is one of the messages I'm trying to get across with the consequence of cowardice, that this is our time to prove that our blood is still valid. Because we can argue about, we can talk about the greatness of our ancestries and remember that and remember how great we are. But we have to also remember that it is our duty to show our blood's worth in our time.
Yeah. And you don't just, at that time, you weren't just because you were born into, well, privilege or royalty, aristocratic lines. You weren't just granted that automatically. Or, as you say, you had to actually prove it. And I many times I think about what's happening today in the same way that, you know, I'm looking at the, you know, the British royal family or something like that, like the farce that they are, that it's like there isn't what made them royals initially was their deeds, not their blood, right? And today it's almost like there are rightful nobility out there, but they're certainly not the ones sitting on the thrones today of any European house, really.
No, I would agree. I mean, it's an hereditary rule is actually an abomination of nature because it demands by right what should be earned by deeds. Like I said, you've got to prove your worth, not demand it as a right. And there's an interesting connection with nobility. I mean, when if we go right back, some of the early bog bodies, I know a lot of people think that they're criminals and that, but if you look at the very early ones, it's clear that they were nobility. They were generally well fed, better fed than the people around them. They had no calluses on their hands, so they weren't working hard. They were generally big in stature, so probably warriors and leaders, and they would be sacrificed. And there's even, and I forgot to look this up because I always forget the name, but in Sweden, where a famous Norse heathen king sacrificed himself in a blot. He was sacrificed to the gods and goddesses. You might know his name.
Yeah. There's a famous painting. I'll pull it up here. A beautiful painting, and it was done by Carl Larsson. Let me see if I can find that here. I'll find it while we keep talking here. But I know what you're talking about. And it was this. The act is basically of recognizing that there was the highest. The king, the chieftain, whatever, that gave of himself to improve the conditions for his people.
Although that is the extreme version of it, that is what nobility is. It is somebody that is willing to stand at the front of the battle. It was someone that willing to he was willing to sacrifice himself for the folk. Therefore, he is worthy of their praise and their tribute. Remember, Tacitus tells about the Germanic tribes that there was not taxes amongst many of the tribes. It was tribute. You gave to the leader or the chieftain that you believe was doing a good job. Something that could be learned with what we do today of where we put our money, but that's another lesson. But
Dumalde was his name. Dumalde. And here's the famous painting by Carl Larsson. showing that kind of the ritual around his sacrifice. Here's the king right there, and the high priest and stuff. But yeah, it's a beautiful painting. It's on a kind of in a mural form today.
Yeah, I mean, he's sacrificing himself to the gods for his folk. And as soon as a nobility decides that they're more valuable than their folk, they become a parasite. They demand the tribute, but now not tribute, they demand it as taxes. And they're not willing to die for their folk. Thus, they become essentially just a parasite. They live off the folk, not for the folk.
Yeah.
A lot of altruism gets a bad rep recently, but... I always say, you name me one hero that is not altruistic. A hero is essentially a man that would die for his people. Yeah. That is an altruistic act. Now, has it been abused? Most certainly. But when it's kept within the blood, when it's kept to a folkish ideal, it is actually the height of greatness to be willing to lay down your life. I mean, it's what a soldier does, right? It's what anybody that wants to protect their folk, they've got to be willing to die for them.
It's almost it's the reverse of that, right? Those that are expected to give the most is those who really don't have anything, and it's the upper crusts, the elites, which are, you know, they're not the ones that are going first into battle. They're not the ones suffering from the decisions that they're making, and they're not sacrificing anything for their own people. In fact, they're traitors to us today.
Parasites. I mean, there's a great example of Calus Rex, which was actually he was a bit of an odd king at the time, because rather than he took back the old ways of fighting at the front, actually, he led the charge. He was actually killed, I believe, in Norway, charging down muskets. I mean, charging down guns. He was shot in the head. I mean, you'll know a lot about Calus Rex. I mean, a great Swedish king. But he took back the ancient ways and started to lead from the front. And he had victory after victory. And the only time he lost was when he was injured and couldn't be on the field, just showing the power of a leader. A true leader, a leader that's willing to die for you. The men will follow anywhere. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. Was it Norway? I'm checking that up here just in case. I thought it was in Pommern first, in Prussia. He died, but I could be wrong on that. I'm looking at it right now. We'll see here. But yeah,
he was at war with Russia, Prussia, and Norway. So
I know exactly. And I mean, he was ahead of a huge. I mean, it was almost. People have said that this epoch of Swedish history is almost like a flashback, if you will, to Viking times, right? We had the Carolingian army, which was just, again, we were not many numbers, but it was incredibly effective. And interestingly enough, there was even some mimicking in what the Germans later managed to achieve with like Blitzkrieg and stuff like that, right? There was a highly educated professional military force, few in numbers, but they were tremendously fast, you know, like operated in a totally different way, you know. But yeah, it's amazing reading about all of this history, you know.
Yeah, I mean, something that's amazed me, the more and more research I do into our ancestors from as far back as you can go, especially Iron Age, because we have a lot of recordings, it's almost like you could write 100 movies without really having to have any creative talent. It's all there. The drama, the heroism. It's literally there in the writings. And these are writings by our enemies too. So if our enemies are praising us so highly, then it bears a testament to our ancestors' nature. And like I say, that's one of the reasons that I created Mimisbrunner with others. There's Riss that does the, I'd better give them a mention. There's Riss that is the magician behind the videos. And there's also Hallinder that's the genius behind the music. But one of these is to kind of remember who we are, what we are, what our blood has already achieved, and to try and bring that forward. Because sadly at the moment, there's a lot of talk, but there's little action in our attempt to free ourselves from the modern threat of Rome, the modern globalization. I mean, we're already conquered. We're like, we are conquered in the sense of like the Cannae or the Brigantines in Britain, but we can still revolt. And these constant results from the north, constantly revolting, constantly fighting for their freedom, eventually wore Rome down.
Yes.
And they came out victorious. And they took...
Would you say the Cimbri like initiated that first wave? I mean, it's not until really the Visigoths teaming up with other tribes like the Vandals and stuff like that later in, what is that, 450 or something, that they managed to sack Rome. Is that the right year? Or is
around
it delayed?
Then, yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's around then because you have the migration period, which is about that time. Yeah. So,
yeah.
Not necessarily, but they gave, it's probably one of the reasons the Germanic tribes, as they record them, and this is where we get the funny things with the Germanic, right? What is Germanic? Well, Germanic, the Germanic tribes were everywhere Caesar hadn't conquered. So he went back and said, I conquered all of Gaul. So he neatly drew a line where it wasn't Gaul, because otherwise he hadn't conquered all of Gaul, right? So there's little things there, but they were definitely, I mean, Tacitus mentions that, he literally says in his book on Germania that, you know, these people of the north, the Germans, have cost Rome more consuls, more leaders, more armies than any other people, any of Rome's enemies.
Yeah.
But you hear very little of this. You know, you hear the Carthaginians and all this, and all Hannibal and his elephant and all this kind of stuff. But you rarely hear the praise lapped upon the Germanic tribes and the northern tribes in general for the constant resistance to Roman rule, even when conquered. I mean, yeah. Vercingetorix, you know, there's so many that rose up, even when they'd been defeated. The Iceni, and even to the end, and this is something that a consequence of cowardice is really trying to put, that these people lived their lives as free. The consequence of cowardice actually came right out of trying to understand why they would kill their children. You have a child yourself, I believe, and I have children. And when you first hear that, like you were saying at the beginning, there's like this... Well, it kind of really jars your thinking, right? You're like, yep. Well, how could you? And then you realize that after much thought of it, I realized that although losing your children or losing anybody you love is a painful experience, what's worse is having it at the hands of a sicko, right? The hands of somebody that's not going to give them a fast death, that's going to torture them. And I think this is how the Cimbri saw slavery.
Yeah, what life is that worth living, right?
Yes. And the Cimbri left the world as they entered it, free and noble.
Yeah. Yeah.
They took from Rome their prize as well, of slaves, and went back to their mother, the mother in the sky, you know, the mother goddess, and went back into her arms with their heads held high.
Now, do you, I forget if, was it the Teutons, right, that the people have speculated that one of the servile uprisings in Rome was actually run by Teutons or Cimbris, right? That there was many people still had survived, that they all hadn't been, like, exterminated by the Romans?
Yeah, a lot got exterminated. But there is evidence that some, especially the Teutons, some of those would probably certainly get captured, because they get the Teutons and the Cimbri split up at one point and they get dealt with separately. So definitely the Teutons, but yeah, in the famous uprising of Rome of Spartacus, yeah, they believe that, you know, if you read the story or even seen the movie of Spartacus, there's the Germanic ones that kind of are always disagreeing with Spartacus and going their own way, etc. That's believed to be the Teutons or and Cimbri survivors mostly, or having a big part in that.
Right, right. All right, so I mean, it's a fascinating story, this one about the Cimbri. And what was it for you that attracted you? You kind of covered some of that already, but was that something you dived into like right away? Or why did you decided to put so much focus on them? Or is that just the initial stages of your work?
It's one of the initial stages, but I try to learn when I do my research, I try to learn as much as I can. I try to truly understand what they saw. And this can be quite emotional sometimes when you're trying to really understand the mindset, especially with the Cimbri and the children thing. I mean, that was quite an emotional journey to try and understand what they were doing. And the result of that emotional journey was consequence of cowardice. So, but the Cimbri, I was just compelled. And there's many lessons I've learned from the Cimbri. And I do this with everything. There's almost too much to look at. I've got a million ideas, and it's trying to get these ideas out in articles and videos and is almost too much to do. And this is why one of the reasons I encourage people to talk, even if you disagree with each other, I find there's a lot of internet beefs over certain things, but just the act of talking about these things, just the act of through your own blood, being the owner, being your own lens to the past, you will know what your blood would have done. And you will feel that as you look, and you will generally be attracted to certain tribes and certain groups. And even if you disagree with somebody else, that conversation is important. That remembering our ancestors is vital as a part of, as obviously I'm a practicing heathen, part of my practice is worship of the ancestors, the reverence that I give to them. And for me, I've been on the sidelines and looking in at a lot of what's going on with our people in modern times. And I didn't act for many years. And it was only when I started to fully try to understand my ancestors that I started to feel a great power. I started to feel empowered. I stopped feeling like just another cog in the wheel. And I started to not blow my ego up to something, but I started to believe in myself and the belief that I could change things. And that started to make me act. And that, you know, so I start Mimas Monitors so people can, hopefully I can pass that kind of feeling on more than anything, that they themselves look into their ancestry, that they themselves try to be inspired by it and remember their ancestors and, you know, take from it something that can make them resist what we're up against today.
Yeah.
Because
beautiful. Yeah. Well said, you know, and it's true. It's very much the same path. At least when I started going into these kinds of topics of really addressing
yes.
what the globalists really are doing, what we're up against, why they're doing yes. it, and just discovering the amazing feature of all of our ancestors, and then realize that that's something that they're trying to effectively exterminate. That's the only word I can find for it. And one thing that really bothers me and worries me too, for obvious reasons, is this issue that we talked about historically, that these areas of the North have been, their tribes have been pouring out of there and different mm-hmm. people have accomplished different things later on in other parts of Europe and stuff like that. And now it feels to me in our modern age that they're trying to, if we can call it a wellspring or a fountain of sorts, as we said, they're trying to snuff that out. They're trying to put the yes. lid on that once and for all and making sure that genetically, biologically, ethnically, racially, that we will cease to exist as a people up in the north of Europe. That's what I feel, and that's a nightmare, obviously, to me. That's mm-hmm. it's kept me up many nights and thinking of what kind of future is my child going to grow up yes. in? All of our children? What kind of world would that be? Where's our place in the world going to be if there's nothing that's exclusively ours anymore? You know what I mean?
Well, yes, that's covered in A Consequence of Cowardice. Obviously, towards the latter part of that video, I go in what the consequence of cowardice is. When you stop behaving like the Kimbri, when you stop having that force, it's not that you just die out as well. It's what torture and hell will you go through getting there? And I mean, there's plenty of modern examples of that. I mean, I'm from England, right? And we have the big case that broke a few years ago, although many of us in the nationalist scene knew about it a lot before, was the Rotherham case. 1,400 plus girls, children, systematically raped. What hell did they go through?
Yeah.
Because of our cowardice and my cowardice too. I don't absolve myself from any guilt here. What have I done? And I think these are important questions that we have to raise. Are we cowards? Nobody wants to call themselves a cowards, but realistically, we have to look at our position, look at what we're doing, and people are too scared today to even speak. You know, if you say something like a Jewish influence, people go, oh no, you might get arrested, and that might be possible in my country. But if I'm too scared to say something because they say I'm not allowed to say it, then all they have to do is make whatever I want to say illegal and I'll shut up. And that's cowardice in any form. The Ikenai, many people attack Boudica, and I hate this type of idea that she should have just shut up and, you know, she cost their lives. And we see this throughout history with World War II, etc., that because they stood up against the bully, because they stood up against the power that was humiliating them and torturing them, essentially, that they are to blame for their demise. I mean, it's something that I find infuriating. You know, just it's the same mentality that the bullied get at school, isn't it? Like, well, if I hit him back, he'll only hurt me more. Well, then you'll always be bullied, right? He's
yep,
always going to take right. your money. If you hit him back, he might hit you harder. But if you do it continually, hit him back, like our ancestors did to Rome, eventually they back off.
Yep.
I mean, they backed off of Germany because the Germanic peoples kept giving them defeats. They kept, although they would, you know, Arminius give them defeat. Germanicus went there and got retribution for that defeat, but they still didn't conquer it
no,
because they kept getting a bloody nose.
That's right. Exactly. We have to fight. That's what it's about. You know, we have to. And obviously, we don't live in the times of the Cimbri. No. You know, and so and things are vastly different. We can't be stupid about it. Obviously, we have to take our battles. We have to see what the equivalent is of what the level of bravery is that they had available to them at their disposal. What they could effectively done. Obviously, sure, yes. they lost their lives and stuff, but the fact is they didn't have armies with nuclear bombs ultimately as their enemies against them, if you see what I mean. It wasn't the...
I agree.
And the technology wasn't there, the surveillance grid, the perpetual police state. It was a very different times, obviously.
Yeah, I'm not suggesting we pull out our iron swords and go charge on the Houses of Parliament, not at all. What I'm suggesting is, like I said earlier, just an act of defiance today with laws, just speaking out can get you, can lose you your job, get you put in jail. Just for people are getting sent to jail for tweets. I mean, they're tweeting something, getting sent to jail. So
it's amazing.
I mean, that is, they can take away your freedom for that in my country and many countries in Europe for saying the wrong thing.
Yeah.
So even there, we have an equivalent to bravery. A man that's willing to stand up and say what he feels, regardless of the consequences, is not a coward.
That's right. That's right. Exactly. So, and that's where it begins, too, of us asserting ourselves and affirming that these ideas are something we're going to stand up for, and we're going to be dissenting against this system, which is effectively is there to enslave us and to perpetually alter the course of nations and our people, you know, Phil.
Yeah. I'll get into some quotes in the second half because I know that we're probably coming to the end of this one, but I'll get into some quotes that really parallel Rome. And I mean, some of these quotes from Tacitus almost could be written about this time. I mean, they are really powerful quotes to just understand what we are up against and what it's going to take to resolve this situation.
We have about 10 minutes. You want to take a few of those? It could be good to get some samples of those.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. It was me getting the time.
No worries. Yeah, of course. No worries. Yeah, I'll read some of those. That'd be interesting hearing.
Well, we've just to put a little caveat in about what it's about. When the Romans conquered Britain, there's a great piece called Agricola by Tacitus. And there's so much in there, and I advise everybody to read it. It's not very long. And there's so much in there that tells us about the nature of Rome. And there's, I mean, some people could accuse Tacitus of actually romanticizing the British slightly in some of his, especially his Galgacha speech, which we did actually have up on the YouTube channel. But we had some copyright issues with BBC Scotland, so we had to take it down. But we are working on a remake of that, which should be up soon.
Oh, good.
But I'd like to... Here's an idea of the globalist connection with Rome, just how our ancestors saw it. And you tell me in this, and I'll do a few quotes, but in this one, I mean, we can go through each one. But here's a quote from Tacitus's Agricola. He likewise, and he here is Agricola himself, he likewise provided a liberal education for the sons of the chiefs and showed such a preference for the natural powers of the Britons over the industry of the Gauls that they who had lately disdained the tongue of Rome now coveted its eloquence. Hence, too, a liking sprang up for our style of dress, and the toga became fashionable. Step by step, they were led to things which disposed to vice, the lounge, the bath, the elegant banquet. All this, in their ignorance, they called civilization, when it was but a part of their servitude. I mean, that alone there shows you just how, I mean, this is Rome's tactic. Tacitus is telling us what Rome do in that quote.
Yeah.
And how they get us into, I mean, this is directly comparable to entertainment, right? We're told this is fashionable and we start, liberalism is fashionable, right? It's this virtue signaling, like, I love immigrants. I love this. I love that. And they get a status from it. And the state rewards that status. You're a good boy. You're a good girl. You're going to get promoted. You're going to get the jobs. It's the exact same tactic that Roman used. I mean, he provided a liberal education, you know. This is exactly. I mean, we also have the nature of actually what they want. Yeah. Same work. Tactics. Neither the East nor the West has been able to satisfy them. Alone among men, they covet with equal eagerness poverty and riches. to robbery, slaughter, plunder, they give the lying name of empire. They make a desert and call it peace. In that part, we're seeing that even poor, they want the poor. People think that the people on the dole, in my country, as they call it, or people, they need the poor because that gives them extra workers, excessive workers, or in this case, excessive slaves, which drives down wages, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it's quite easy. But I'll finish with the last quote there, so I get them all out of the way. Same work again. But now tell me if this is not something that we feel today in our nations. Nature has willed that every man's children and kindred should be his dearest objects. Yet these are torn from us by conscriptions to be slaves elsewhere. Our wives and our sisters, even though they may escape violation from the enemy, are dishonored under the names of friendship and hospitality. Our goods and fortunes they collect for their tribute, our harvests for their granaries. Our very hands and bodies under the lash and in the midst of insult are worn down by the toil of clearing forests and morasses. Creatures born to slavery are sold once for all and are moreover fed by their masters. But Britain is daily purchasing, is daily feeding her own enslaved people. And as in a household, the last comer among the slaves is always the butt of his companions. So we, in a world long used to slavery, as the newest and the most contemptible, are marked out for destruction.
Wow.
That is Galgacus. That is Tacitus putting words into the mouth of a Caledonian chief called Galgacus.
Interesting. Wow. And the parallels, too, there. To today.
There are a lot of parallels.
Very interesting, yeah. Yeah, because, I mean, obviously there's... And we could talk about that for a bit, too, but there is... a sense of pride among many Europeans for the Roman Empire and what they achieved and stuff like that. And I understand some of that, or the organization, the military. I mean, they did, but the fact is that at that time, that was like, as you expressed, it was like that was the globalization at the time. They were effectively homogenizing the known world. They even, almost in a, if you want to make a Star Trek analogy here, but almost like how the how the Borg... conquers one, a new race, a new people, and they absorb them into their system, and they end up using the strengths and the knowledge that it has to continue its expansion effectively, which is, of course, as a survival organism or whatever you want to call it, it is to be admired, but it certainly was the enemy of many tribes and many people, and we're far less diverse today because of that, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely seen as the globalism of its time. I mean, and those, I mean, the British Empire is kind of the spiritual inheritor of Rome, really. The British Empire, the British nobility really admired Rome. I mean, if you went back to even like the 40s and previous, the Bronze Age, Iron Age, they were kind of seen as barbarians. They believed the Roman writings and essentially dismissed them. I mean, even up until the early 1900s, people believed that the Iron Age forts were built by Romans because these barbarians before them couldn't build anything. So we have these ideas, and they took the same lessons. They read Agricola. They knew how to do this by essentially, like you say, assimilating the people into them, getting them to dress in the togas, forcing their hands of slavery. But I mean, in that last quote there, we are marked out for destruction. It is, and I am I don't mince my words with that. This is white genocide, in my point. When they erase your history, or begin to try to erase your history, they begin to tell you, I mean, how many times I've seen news articles with new Swedes. I mean, what the hell is that? A new Swede? Well, what, where are the old Swedes? Where are they going?
Exactly. Yeah, just give way. It's a new era now. Hey, did you see that National Geographic's cover, The New Europeans? Same thing, a huge spread online. They had these moving photos, almost like video clips that were looping and stuff on their website. And it's just like, they've been marketing that idea like crazy the last 10 years. But since the wrap-up of the so-called migrant crisis, when our leaders decided to effectively just open the borders or not enforce the laws of our countries and the borders that do exist there, they've really tried to put that forward as an idea of like, this is something good, this is something exciting that's happening, and but effectively it's an erasure process that's going on right now.
It is a complete destruction. Yeah, we are marked out for destruction, just as the Caledonians believe they were, and their cultures were. their cultures never fully recovered after Roman left. I mean, they were invaded then by Germanic tribes, but the invasions there were probably more peaceful than people believe, or what is later written, because what is later written is generally around the same time as the Norman conquest. And the Normans, justifying their own conquest, say that you were conquerors too. So there's a bit of propaganda in there. But
sure, yeah.
Rome was definitely, it had a tactic. And sadly for Rome, I mean, the reason the Cimbri asked for land at each asking. Each time they meet the Roman army, they go, give us land and we'll give you our swords. Essentially, mm-hmm. we'll fight for you. One of the main reasons the Romans couldn't give them land is because they already had massive land problems. And this wasn't because they didn't have enough land, clearly. Rome had a lot of land, but it was that the rich founding families were not keen to give their land up to the lower classes and not willing to allow them to have it. So they were having riots. And what happened with Rome, we know about their politics where, you know, murder was common among Roman disagreements, backstabbing. Oh, yes. I mean, many of the people that I forgot their names now, but that started the land reforms were murdered before they could get their, essentially what would be kind of like their bills passed in the Senate. They were murdered before they could speak, etc. So it was the corruption at the top, this idea that the wealthy wanted to remain wealthy, that they couldn't really ally with the Cimbri, which would have made sense for the Roman army. They would have got a great fighting force, and the Cimbri would have got ultimately what they wanted, which people wonder why they did it. And Romans accuse them of plunderer and all of these things. But every time they meet an Roman army, they ask for land. So it's clear what they want. They just want land to bring up their children and families, like everybody does, right?
Yeah, and how they must have viewed that at that time, right? Again, you know, that the land that you worked tied you to it, and you know, the concept of blut und Boden, blood and soil, right? Effectively,
yes.
And this aspect too, that if you don't have land, you don't have it anything. You're not anywhere that you could be rooted. And again, we don't truly know all the was it simply overpopulation? Was it climactic things that caused them? You know, many people speculate that. I mean, if you go way back into the record, there's even it's not even mythical at this point. It's actually proven that it was a landmass between the continent, Europe, and the British Isles. They called it Doggerland. Have you read up on that?
Yeah, Doggerland, yeah.
That was prone to flooding for different reasons. This is the reasons why Holland has built all those dikes, and literally they're underwater today, but if they removed those dikes, it would be flooded underwater. And much of the same thing had happened up in Denmark and Jutland and stuff like that. So it seems to be, maybe a combination of the fact that they were successful, so they were overpopulated, which is kind of also a noble idea if you think back to it, that the aspect mm-hmm. that you weren't just to plunder and rape the land and leave it without any resources left on it. They understood that for us and for nature to survive, we have to spread out, right?
Yeah, This is a natural war. There are two types of war. Rome was the greed war, right? That of conquest and domination. They wanted slaves and land for more wealth. The Roman, the people living in Rome didn't need more land. They conquered the people and left the people on the land because they were slaves to Rome. Then they kept a slave class within these. They would maybe like treat the chiefs and some of the higher ups and convince them, to go along with them by plying them with gold and wine. But it wasn't because the Roman people needed land. It was for dominance and greed, essentially. The Cimbri were making war for the essential of life, which is land. Which is, I always class that as a natural war. That is, there is nothing wrong with two people, and neither the defender or the attacker in a war over land to live on, to work yourself, is against nature. The army defending is completely moral because they are defending their land to feed their children. But the army attacking is completely moral too. If they have no land to feed their children, then they have to, nature ordains that you must find sustenance for your children. That is the we can argue about the meaning of life, but it's pretty clear that we need to have children and continue. That's what everything does on the planet. Every living thing, creature, does that. So they are natural wars. When we start declaring wars for, which what the British Empire did, it, My at the time, at the height of the British Empire, I had some of my family, because I've traced my descendants, they were living in poor houses. They were going to war and dying, but their family wasn't getting any of the wealth that they were earning from these conquests.
Yeah,
it was being siphoned by the elite through our blood, and this is what Rome was doing with its own too. Well, not at this point, actually, because you had to be a landed person in the Roman Republic to have to be in the military. But it was actually Kimbrian War that changes that, because they deplete so many of their forces. Gaius Marius has to change the law, essentially.
We're going to take a break here in just a little bit. This is very interesting. I'm going to continue this conversation here in part two. And I want to leave people with a little bit of a clip here at the end of this first part from...
Yeah.
The Consequences of Cowardice is just brilliant. And then I want people to go and check out the whole series. It's are there more parts coming? You have three so far on the Kimbri War. What's next in that series?
There's two more parts, and they're actually the better parts. The first three are kind of establishing the background. The final part we're going to try and make as a standalone as well, because there's a lot of lessons to be learned in that part. And it will make a great story.
What a movie, huh? That would be this story. An amazing movie. It's just, you know, it's amazing that it hasn't been done, to be honest.
Yeah, well, Rhys has the ability to film. He's talented in that way, but we have thought, we just couldn't afford. We've got no funds to make
it's budget.
Anything even close.
No, of course it's budget, exactly. But you know, it's going to change. These things are going to change as whites rediscover their identity because of the fact that they're being attacked in the way that they are. More people are going to be attracted by these ideas. They're going to want to know, they're going to want to understand what it is that they are attempting to eradicate, etc. So I'm sure that this is coming. But again, awesome work on the videos. I just love a lot of it. And again, I just want to continue to talk more about this in the second part here. But anything else then people should look out for? What do you have upcoming? Obviously, you have articles on your website too. We can show that. You have a bunch of articles. You have videos and stuff like that. What do you usually spend most of your time on working on? Is it videos or articles?
Both. I try to get an article up every Wednesday. And we get a video up every 2 weeks. And we've maintained that deadline so far. Even sometimes it has been last minute with some of it. If you actually click, I need to sort that out. Sorry, I'm not. Like I say, there's three of us doing it. I take care of most of the. I design the website too, and I'm not a web designer. So if there are any little problems, I do apologize.
No, looks good. Looks good. Yeah, no worries. All right, awesome. And obviously, we'll have links, guys, to the YouTube channel Mimis Brunner. Check that out. Make sure you subscribe. Check out new upcoming videos as well. But again, that The Consequence of Cowardice is brilliant. I think that's the one that had the most views too on your YouTube channel. I think that's for a reason, don't you?
Yeah, way more
it
views.
It strings true to many people today, I think, when they watch that and like you really question, like, yeah, what is it that's happening here? What is it that we're, what are we waiting for in terms of fighting back? And again, what I'm talking about is this initial step of beginning to show your discontent. I mean, the reality is, if more people simply spoke out, helped to awaken their fellow man, and actually, even at this stage, voted for the very people that are there to even remotely have sense of nationalism, we would begin to shift direction and go in the right direction, right? But
but
there's so many cowards among our people.
It's a Spartacus moment.
Yeah.
If we, you know, well, I'm Spartacus, right? If we all start saying what we feel, are they going to arrest everybody?
They get to the overwhelming
numbers. But we need to reignite that passion. That idea of resistance that has been a part of Northern history, resistance. I mean, resistance to tyranny. I mean, even in later British history, we have rebellion after rebellion. Where we got to did not get there just by them simply taking it. We have fought continuously for the last few thousand years for any rights that we do have.
Absolutely. All right, beautiful. I'll play a few clips, or we'll see what we do here at the end of it. But I want to play a little bit from the Consequences of Cowardice, and then I want you to go and watch the rest of that one, guys, because it's really good. But we're going to continue with Phil Simpson in the second part, so definitely make sure you check out redicemembers.com. That's a great way to support us as well. You do have a Patreon, by the way. How can people support your work?
Patreon. We do also have shirts up for sale, which are organic.
That's good.
But we try to keep in keeping with our own and printed locally. They're not printed by any big multi-corporation. We try to do things as best we can with the resources that we have to keep the quality and our standards. You know, I don't want to talk bad on multinational corporations, then use them.
So. Yeah, it's true. It's true. Yeah. When did you set up the site and start doing videos, by the way?
I set up the site probably about a year ago. Maybe
Been up that long. That's why, because first however, I'm not come across this before, but it hasn't been available for that long, basically.
So. No, and the videos were a little bit after that. And then we kind of made them sporadically at first as well. And then we decided, you know, we're getting a lot of positive comments. A lot of people are liking our stuff. So we give ourselves deadlines. And we've been running behind ever since.
I know that feels, man. Same here. It's like, let's do this and this and that. And all the ideas and everything. And then it's like you realize the limitation of just working with, well, especially video, as you know now, how long that takes and the effort and time that goes into that. But again, you guys are doing a great work, so thank you for doing it. Definitely keep it up. And check out the stuff, subscribe, follow, support on Patreon, all that good stuff. Check out the shop, and we'll be back in part two here with Phil Simpson from Mimirus Brunner. Stay tuned, we'll be right back.
But as they pursued those that fled to their camp, they witnessed a most fearful tragedy. The women, standing in black clothes on their wagons, slew all that fled. Some their husbands, some their brethren, others their fathers. Plutarch on the Cimbri. Plutarch's words give us a powerful insight into the minds of our northern ancestors. Of course, this is a Roman writing, and as such it may be a little embellished, but there can be no doubt that our forebears viewed acts of cowardice with the utmost disdain. Tacitus, in his book Germania, on the origin and situation of the Germans, re-emphasizes this harsh perspective. To give ground provided that you return to the attack is considered good tactics rather than cowardice. They bring back the bodies of the fallen even when a battle hangs in the balance. To throw away one's shield is the supreme disgrace, and the man who has thus dishonored himself is disbarred from attendance at sacrifice or assembly. Many such survivors from the battlefield have ended their shame by hanging themselves. Tacitus. The notion that dropping one's shield was an act of the utmost cowardice is also shared by the great Greek warrior tribe, the Spartans. The phrase, on your shield or with it, is often said to be the last words a Spartan man would hear from his beloved wife before he set off for battle. The phrase essentially boils down to victory or death, leaving no room for live to fight another day. In these examples, we see the sternness of belief, that there was no greater loss than the loss of one's honor. We also see how important the role of the women folk was in maintaining this noble virtue, bravery. The Gaulish peoples would often mock Roman tactics as acts of cowardice. Plutarch gives us a great example of this in his work, Lives of the Noble Greeks and Romans. Upon the meeting of the Roman army and that of the Teutons in the Cimbrian Wars, the Romans, under orders from Gaius Marius, hole up in their encampment, refusing to come out and fight. This cowardly behavior was met with mocking from the noble Teutons. After several days of pointless pleading and goading to get the cowardly Romans out of their hole, they finally give up. On their way, though, they had a few last slighting remarks for their adversaries. And they marched close to the camp, inquiring whether the Romans had any messages for their wives. For, they said, we shall soon be with them. Plutarch and the Teutons. It should also be noted that the Romans lived up to their accusations of cowardice. The Teutons, along with the Ambrones, were eventually defeated by the armies of Gaius Marius after they were attacked in the most cowardly manner. Whilst eating and bathing with their families, the Romans took advantage and launched an ambush. Even when facing the impossible, the Ambrones stood their ground, beating on their shields and chanting their holy name. So proud was their chanting, it can still be heard in noble hearts to this day. This custom of disdain for cowardice was not only present in ancient times. Many of you will already know that under Norse law, to call someone a coward was a serious charge. Many such an accusation would end in a duel, lest the accused wish to live in shame by accepting the title. This was true of Anglo-Saxon culture too. Wulfstan, who wrote the laws for both King Canute and Ethelred, clearly states, "And the man who shall flee from his lord or from his comrade by reason of his cowardice, let him forfeit all that he owns and his own life." From this, it is clear that anyone guilty of cowardice was rendered practically dead to the society, or worse still, relinquished of their life by it. So why was cowardice seen as such a crime? To get insight into this, we must try to understand how our ancestors viewed cowardice. Most of our modern ideas of cowardice are similar to that of Aristotle's, which is that cowardice is driven by excessive fear and that all men are capable of succumbing to it. To be a coward, therefore, is to fear all things. The brave man, on the other hand, is someone who conquers this instinct. Aristotle also mentions another possibility to overcome fear, rashness, which he states is the quality of a madman that does not know fear. It is interesting here that when given an example of this, Aristotle uses the Celts. Of those who go to excess, he who exceeds in fearlessness has no name, but he would be sort of a madman or insensible person if he feared nothing. Neither earthquakes nor waves, as they say the Celts do not. Aristotle. This is an intriguing little addition to Aristotle's work and may point to some fundamental clash of philosophical outlooks. When we look back at tribes like the Cimbri and their actions, to our modern mind they can appear rash. They seem to fight with wanton abandonment, almost as if they have no value for their own lives or that of their loved ones. So were they rash, or is it a case of completely different philosophical perspectives? I doubt even the Celts or the Cimbri would deny that fear plays a part in cowardice. But for them, there seems to be more at play. Could it be that the uncivilized barbarians, unlike their civilized counterparts, did not see fear as a motivational force? This would render it obsolete as an excuse, and thus anything fear-based would be a choice made, not an instinctual action. If it was viewed as a choice, not an unavoidable consequence, this could explain its harsh treatment. Richard Abel, in his work Cowardice and Duty in Anglo-Saxon England, comes to much the same conclusion. The cowardice was essentially a choice, or at least viewed that way in Anglo-Saxon times. In this modern world, these subtle differences can be hard to see. We live in a culture entrenched in baseline emotions. Fear, lust, and the rest dominate our societies, where everyone has an insincere excuse based on some visceral urge or emotion. It's never anyone's fault. There is always some reason for their lacking. These animalistic forces act as a kind of an emotional currency. Anytime you feel bad, you can exert some primitive feeling as a quick fix. Mimic fear to get sympathy. Indulge in lust to get the amygdala kick. It has become quite popular. The emotional vampires among us sucking on that sympathy like their lives depended on it. Because they do. What if our ancestors had conquered such unevolved urges? That unlike their civilized counterparts who pondered and excused these instincts, they rose above them. What force, though, has the power to render the primitive obsolete while still maintaining a devotion to all that is natural? Where fear is a problem in our modern societies, like the military, we use regimental discipline and military drills. This serves the man by replacing emotional responses with habits developed in training. Now, from all the texts I have read on our ancient forebears, military discipline was not one of their qualities. They, as Aristotle suggested, often appear rash, almost overly emotional. They did not keep fear at bay by remembering drills. Something else drove them. Some higher arc or higher principle. There is only one force I know of that can reduce fear to a choice and still hold nature in reverence, and that is love. To my mind, our ancestors, far from being uncivilized, were in fact truly enlightened. To give in to fear was to forsake your love for your family and folk. It was to hold a primitive urge above all you hold dear. It was to reduce life itself to a desperate struggle of the primitive mind, instead of lifting it up to the most sacred of all the gifts of the gods and goddesses. Their rash appearance was not due to madness, but an expression of their reverence for life. The Kimbri may have died on that battlefield many years ago, but in that moment, they truly lived. A modern man could live 100 lifetimes and never know such freedom. Never knowing the true value of the breeze upon his face or the precious smile of a loved one. The civilized mind, the slave mind, recoils in fear at such a sight. Unable to process it, it declares it madness, because he who has never lived can never know life's meaning. They spend all their time avoiding it and reasoning their way out of it. These societies produce thinkers. They forever talk about life without ever living it. Our barbarian ancestors did not talk it, they walked it. It embodied every action they made. They left us no books, only their deeds from which we must learn. Love does conquer all, but not in a pitiful manner. Love sets about routing from the battlefield of life or illusions or fears. A man who can wield the power of love in all areas of his life is the unbeatable, the immovable object. Fear is an illusion. It seeks to trick you, make you believe that existence, no matter how pitiful, is more important than living. It plots to turn slavery into an option and blame the righteous for the ills of the world. It is important to remember when I speak of love, I do not mean some pitiful modern expression of it. Love only has value if it is discriminatory. The idea that anyone can love all things equally is a lie told by cowards to convince themselves their cowardice is enlightenment. Friedrich Nietzsche expressed it best when he said, "I have often laughed at the weaklings who thought themselves good because they had no claws." Slavery was seen as a fate worse than death, as it strips the man of his manhood and reduces his children to the property of another. This is the true goal of compassion, to refuse suffering at any cost. It is only in the Germanic and Celtic languages that the word freedom originates in the word for love. Only in the ancient North does love set you free. Only in the ancient North is freedom seen as the ultimate expression of love. Thus, a man who claims to love his folk and family could never see slavery as an option.